The 2024 calendar only allows for 4 weeks of Advent, and that's because Thanksgiving was so late this year. Last year, we had 5 Sundays of Advent, and it just goes according to the calendar and when Easter falls and all those kind of things. And so we are starting week 4 today, which is a focus on the birth of Christ, commemorating the fulfillment that Yahweh God started this plan in motion nearly 2,000 years ago. How Luke's inspired gospel, and that's where we have stayed this year, has taken us as readers, as searchers of the scriptures, from the temple courts and inside the inner holy place of the temple, in front of the altar of incense. We're introduced to an elderly priest by the name of Zechariah, who is serving there. And it's by lot. He is drawn. There's about 24,000 priests, and many of them never get the opportunity. But at this specific time, Zechariah's number was drawn. He's there alone in the Holy of Holies. He is lighting the incense, and an angel appears to him. God has broken his silence of over 400 years. There's not been a prophetic message. Israel has been living off the Torah and living on hope, and suddenly this angel by the name of Gabriel comes and startles Zechariah with amazing news that his barren wife, unable to conceive, their elderly folks, is going to conceive and have a child. And his name is going to be John. He is the messenger. He is the forerunner. 400 years before, almost 450 years before, the prophet Malachi, the last prophet in the Old Testament, in the Torah, tells that one in the same mold as Elijah is coming. He is going to be a herald. He's going to be the messenger that is paving the way for Messiah to come. And John and Elizabeth are honored to have this come upon them. Plus, their days of sadness and barrenness are coming over. In the process, Zechariah shows doubt, and he is struck with muteness. So he goes home and tries to communicate with his wife. And just like it was prophesied, Elizabeth conceives. She goes into seclusion because she didn't want to deal with a hubbub. And all of this is going on in the background. All of it is in Luke chapter 1. Nowhere else in the Gospels. Matthew has a little bit of the background of Christ. Mark and John do not. They pick up Christ as a grown man. So Luke gives us the most complete understanding of what's going on here. But John is not the centerpiece. All of this about John and the forerunner is getting ready for the one to come, who turns out to be a relative, his cousin, who's about 6 months younger than him. So during Elizabeth's pregnancy, it's timed by that, it says about 6 months into Elizabeth's pregnancy, the reader is taken somewhere between 80 and 100 miles north of Jerusalem, in the hill country where they were in Judea, to another visitation by the angel Gabriel. This time, not to an elderly woman or man, but to a young teenage girl by the name of Mary. And she is told by the angel that she is going to conceive, that she's going to give birth to a son. His name is going to be Jesus, and he's going to be the Messiah. And she says, but I'm a virgin. And Gabriel says, the Holy Spirit will come upon you and make that happen. And Mary, according to Luke, and most scholars, or many scholars, understand that in Luke, in his research, went and very likely contacted Mary. Mary was alive at that time and got these stories and this narrative firsthand. Mary immediately left her home up in Nazareth in Galilee and traveled, likely alone, 80 to 100 miles down to meet with her relative Elizabeth and spend time, about 3 months there, rejoicing. And Elizabeth exclaims with the Holy Spirit's presence coming upon her. She said that the baby, at the sound of your voice, leapt in my womb. And that's when I said, do you believe in miracles? Because all of this is miraculous. Angels appearing. Prophetic utterances given. Things almost too good to be true. Luke takes us through the birth of John, the circumcision of John, and the naming of John. And in the middle of this, because Zechariah is mute, they said, what is his name going to be? And Elizabeth says, his name is going to be John. And they said, hey, none of your relatives, none of your ancestors have that name. They contested it. And they asked Zechariah, and he asked for something to write on, and he said, his name is John, and immediately the muteness leaves him. And there is this song of praise at the end of chapter 1 of Luke. And that's where we left off last week, that these mighty things were happening. So we're going to pick it up today with Mary and Joseph. All of this is part of God's plan. Somewhere along in her pregnancy, Joseph still took her as his wife. All of this is very unconventional. Not so much in our day, but that a pregnant bride that Joseph knew that had nothing to do with him. But an angel came and explained it to him according to Matthew chapter 1, and he took Mary as his wife. And so let's pick it up at the beginning of chapter 2, Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. Luke says, in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea in Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and of the line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. Christ is born. Let's pull it apart a little bit. Verses 1 through 3. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census would be taken for the entire Roman world. What is notable here is that Luke cements his gospel in history. It is the history of the world, not just the history of the Jewish nation. In many places, especially in the Old Testament, they anchor it with a specific king of Judah or a king of Israel or even a family line. This is anchored in world history. It could be taken back. It was the reason why Christians would say, why is the calendar, when you look at history like this, B.C., and suddenly it becomes A.D.? Well, in modern days, what they do is they go, it's before Common Era and Common Era. They've tried to change that away from the birth of Christ. But the birth of Christ is pivotal here. It says, Caesar Augustus, That is a title. That is a term. That is not his name. At that point in time, early in the Roman Empire, they hadn't quite gotten to emperor worship yet, but it was on the way, just like the pharaohs in Egypt were worshipped as gods. By the time Paul into the New Testament era there, they were shrines and temples for the emperor to worship him. Caesar Augustus means the great Caesar. His real name was Gaius Octavius or Octavian. He was the nephew of Julius Caesar. And if you go back and bone up on your Roman history, there was some things going on and assassinations, and Caesar Augustus got the throne. And he was one of the most stable. He issues a decree for a census. And if you have watched The Chosen at all, especially the early first couple seasons, you realize that, especially with Matthew being a tax collector, that this issue of taxes was a big deal. We dread April 15th because that's the day, if you haven't paid up, that's the day you square up with the government. They had it much worse. They had to show up in person, and they had ledgers and say, pay up. And here was a census that was designed to find out how many people everybody had to register so nobody fell through the cracks. This was all about taxation to Rome. A formal decree from the emperor. This was the first census that was taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. This is in parenthesis right here. And scholars see this as a sticky wicket. Because if you look at the time that Quirinius, again going back in history, was the governor of Syria, it was actually in about AD 6, 7, right around in there, which would have been a few years after Jesus was born. And what they do is they take that as a use of the Greek term. First can also mean before, that before Quirinius was the governor, or he served in other capacities and this was associated with him. You can get caught up in all these little things and be tripping over little anthills, but that is not a major problem here. And everyone went to their own town to register. This is the key to this whole thing, was that everyone was to go to their ancestral home. Now, amongst all this, and you know this from my study of Revelation, that there are many scholars that have different views on this. Some suggest that maybe Joseph had inherited land from his ancestral area down in Bethlehem and had to go there. Some even suggested that Joseph lived there, which kind of is problematic because as we move along in the narrative, why would they have stayed where they did if Joseph had a home, right? So it doesn't make a lot of sense. Plus, living 80 to 100 miles away, why would his family have pledged Mary to Joseph living in a completely different region? There are problems there. So we're going to take it at face value that Joseph and Mary lived in Nazareth up north, and they traveled south because that's where Joseph's family was from. Verses 4 and 5, so Joseph went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea. Whatever the reasoning behind all this, Joseph was obedient to the law. In Romans chapter 12, Paul talks about that, living about under the Roman Empire, and he says, you obey the civil authorities. Jesus says, render to Caesar what is Caesar's. Civil disobedience for just the sake of it is not scriptural. Joseph did what he was instructed to do, and he made that trip down south. The reason it says it went up is the region of Galilee. You've got Galilee up here to the north, you've got Samaria in the middle, and you've got Judea down here. Is that up by the lake, by Lake Gennesaret or the Sea of Galilee, was relatively flat. When you get down, you get into the hill country, and that's why it said he went up. We always talk about as going up north, right? Well, they were going up south. It doesn't sound right, but that's the matter of what was happening there. Where were they going? To Bethlehem, the town of David. Bethlehem was a little village outside of the big city. Maybe it's like a Coopersville. It was approximately 5 miles south. Maybe it's more like a door. About 5 miles south of Jerusalem. Tiny little place. The name Bethlehem means house of bread. Or in earlier days, Ephrathah, which means fruitful. It must have been a rich area. That we know that David was born there. He chased sheep around the hillsides there like the shepherds that Jesse read about. Mighty King David. Why? Because Joseph belonged to the house in the line of David. I mentioned last week that it said Mary was a relative of Elizabeth. And in Luke chapter 1, it says Zechariah was a priest because he was of the tribe of Levi, of Aaron. And his wife was as well. And Mary's related to her, so Mary is very likely from the tribe of Levi. Joseph is from the tribe of Judah, the same lineage as David. So when we get to how did Jesus have that royal lineage, it was because his father Joseph adopted him and he became part of the tribe of Judah. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. So far, we've heard quite a bit about Mary, not a lot about Joseph, but you know that Joseph's a pretty unique guy because he is marrying a lady who's already pregnant. Unusual circumstances. This came back later on when Jesus and they said you were an illegitimate child. People knew. People recognized this. Joseph didn't balk at it. He's taking Mary along with her. And a lot's written on why would Mary go along? Why would she go on this trip? Especially being advanced in her pregnancy. But Joseph was a pretty unique guy. Again, referring back to the chosen, when they had their Christmas special, you see Joseph was a man of character. When they showed flashbacks of what Jesus would have been like working in the shop with Joseph, Joseph was an amazing man. And Joseph was obedient. They became a family unit. Luke says they were betrothed. It didn't say that they were married. We don't know if that marriage had already taken place. We talked previously about the process of a Jewish marriage where the parents would arrange it and there would be a dowry exchange for the bride. The bride would live and she would be considered the wife of the groom even though that they were not formally married. There was no intimacy at all. She would live with her parents up to a year to make sure she was not going to show up with a baby bump. And then they would have the formal wedding, like the wedding in Cana that Jesus was at. And then they would be a family. So it looks like that probably had happened. So it might be that Luke is referring to the fact that because Mary was pregnant and she was still a virgin, that Joseph, they had not consummated their marriage. There was no intimacy between them. So Luke was looking at it by the letter of the law. But one thing is clear, they're a family unit. They're already bonded together in this unusual situation. Where Joseph went, Mary went. They're a team. I see a lot of good marriages in here. And I know it's the same way. Where one goes, the other goes, right? And that's the same exact way. Doesn't that kind of warm your heart? Joseph says, I got to go. Woman's coming with me. We're going together as a team. That's why they were chosen as the parents of Christ. It says, and she was expecting a child. It doesn't tell us how far along at that point. We know that she had spent the first 3 months of her pregnancy with Elizabeth. There's no sense of time here between her coming back to Nazareth and when this happens. We'll find that out in just a little bit. But without a doubt, traveling on a donkey 80 to 100 miles when you're pregnant, no matter how pregnant you are, is going to be sort of an uncomfortable, daunting situation. You have the king of the world. It's what Caesar Augustus considers himself, what the Roman world considers himself. They owned everything worth owning in their mind. But this is the precise way that God is going to bring all of the key players in this story together in the right place by an edict from the emperor to Bethlehem. And whether Luke was alluding to Micah 5:2 or not, probably 500 years before Luke wrote this, Micah said, "But you, Bethlehem Ephratah, Bethlehem the fruitful, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." This is in the process of happening. God orchestrated this whole thing together. Caesar Augustus thinks he's the ruler of the world, but the creator of the world is sovereign. In verses 6 and 7, while they were there, they arrived in Bethlehem. They made the trip. The time came for the baby to be born. Now Luke shares more. Mary's not just pregnant, Mary's very pregnant. Mary's in her 9th month. I remember daughter Anne, who was pretty little, when she was in her 9th month, it looked like she was going to split open like a ripe melon. Her baby bump was huge. There's a picture of her pretty soon, and they're smiling, because am I right, Dave? I mean, it looked like she was carrying the biggest baby on earth. And when that belly gets like that, you know it's time. That is how Joseph loaded up his pregnant wife to make that 3-4-5-day journey down. And she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. Again, much debate over this term, firstborn. What does that mean? Some contend that this simply means that Mary was going to have more children. Some faith groups say that Mary remained a perpetual virgin and had no more children. Yet in Luke 8 and in Matthew 12, it says that Jesus was told, "Your mother and your brothers are standing outside waiting to see you." James is the half-brother of Jesus who wrote the epistle of James. There were more other children coming. Firstborn could mean that. Firstborn in the Jewish culture received the rights. They received most of the birthright. That's why in Jacob and Esau was born just seconds before Jacob, and he got the birthright. And you see all the way through this idea, even with the prodigal son, the younger son is the one that left and he came back, and the older son got the estate, but the father still lavished upon him. And finally, the royal line, that he came from the throne of David. Being here, the firstborn was the one who would have been in line to do that. So whatever Luke had in mind, whether it was a combination of these three things, this is Mary's first child. And it's a son. She was told to name him Jesus earlier. It says she wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger. Now swaddling, that's what we call it today. Swaddling a baby was to keep their limbs straight, to keep them warm, to keep them secure. You know, a baby's in this really confined space for quite a while, and they get out, and they're in the open air, and it's all brand new. I remember when our son Pete was born, And they laid him in this little bun warmer thing off to the side, and he started crying. So I walked over and I picked him up and I held him to me, and maybe they had never seen that before because everybody in the room stopped and looked at me. I said, "What? He's my son." And I just held him and he quit crying. Swaddling does that. It brings him tight. That was common in the day. What was not common in the day was to lay a baby in a manger, in a feeding trough for animals. Even the poorest people who had animals in their house had a special place for a brand newborn member of their family. We're told why, because there was no guest room available for them. Now, a lot has been made about this over the years, over the past nearly 2,000 years, about why there was no room. Some have this old crotchety innkeeper. Maybe you've been traveling and you get to a hotel and the desk clerk is ornery. You know, they don't want to be talking to you right then. They got better things to do. And this is one of the scenes, or that Mary and Joseph are so poor that they can't afford a room. Those are all made up. The term in Greek is called katalamati, which means accommodation. It says there was no accommodations. It doesn't say anything about an inn. It doesn't say anything about a hotel. And typically at that time, when you go back and research it, a small town would have a common area for traveling guests. But because of the census, that had filled up. There was no space for humans any longer in this central enclave. So Mary and Joseph either went to a stable or, more likely, a cave. That's why if you paid a visit to the Holy Land today, they have the Church of Bethlehem is in a cave. And that could be the location. It's possible. It's possible that it's not, and it's just been built up over the years. But it's very likely that Jesus was born in a cave. That's why I said the Christmas cards, you know, the one that had the nice little structure right there with Bethlehem picturesque in the background, you don't really see it as a cave, do you? That is how humble this all happened. The royal decree of powerful Caesar Augustus sent a humble man and his young pregnant wife on a journey to make sure that Messiah was born in the place that Micah had foretold 500 years before that. What kind of a plan is that? Why did God send his son to a cave? Before we wrap up, we're going to go back and look at two other verses. Jesse read the passage about the shepherds. We're not doing that as a focus of our sermon series this year. But you know the stories. The shepherds around Bethlehem see a great light. And all of a sudden, the angel chorus appears and they're singing, "Glory to God in the highest," and the shepherds are terrified. And they are told, go look for a baby who's laying in a manger wrapped in swaddling clothes. What Mary did is exactly what the angels told them to do. So they went. In Luke 2:19-20, the shepherds finally packed it up and went back to their jobs. It says, but Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, which were just as they had been told. I want you to imagine Mary. I saw on Facebook a couple weeks ago, it says, imagine a drummer shows up right after Mary gets baby Jesus to sleep to do a drum solo. And you don't think of little drummer boy that way, right? but you're going, shh, shh, you know? You want that baby to stay quiet. And Mary, all of a sudden, tired, exhausted from the trip, having a baby in a stable, not the most sanitary of places, Joseph, her husband, assisting, how they did it back then. And then all of a sudden, the shepherds show up. And probably mustering all of the grace of a 14, 15, 16-year-old girl who's tired, and her husband, who's got to be at his wit's end because this is not how he pictured any of this, and the shepherds show up. This is in real time. We have years and years to process it. This is happening right in their real time. And the shepherds finally leave, however long that took. And Mary probably heaves a big sigh. Exhausted, ready to take a snooze herself. But it says she was in deep contemplation. These thoughts going around. Maybe she's laying in the straw, trying to go to sleep, and these thoughts are reeling around in her mind, trying to make sense of what's happening, because what the angel told her was only a fraction of what had already happened. It says she treasured them up. She stored them away in her memory. Why? To retell the story. Very likely to Luke himself. Certainly to the disciples, to the people who were around. This is what happened. This is our story. This is the humble beginnings of Messiah. Treasured them up to tell later. Meanwhile, the shepherds have left. They returned to their job, to the fields, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, which was just as they had been told. Think about the people, the cast of characters here. Is anybody in this case who you would cast to be the mother and father and the welcoming committee of the King of the Universe? You go, no, this is kind of crazy. Everyone involved in this special narrative, I'm sure, was permanently impacted by the amazing events that they experienced. Zechariah had experienced an angel visitation. Mary had experienced an angel visitation. Joseph had experienced an angelic visitation. The shepherds. That's enough to make it pretty noteworthy. And then all of the other things coupled together here. That this is Yahweh God's grand plan to bring his son to the world, to bring salvation. These shepherds are profoundly moved. It says they were glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had seen and heard. This is just beyond what these common folks could imagine. But it was exactly as they had been told. And that is so key, because all this prophecy from Micah and Isaiah and the things that are carried through, and certainly when Mary found out that she was carrying Messiah, she had to go back. Her and Joseph sat down with the Torah and really went through it with a fine-tooth comb to get all of these things, to find out what might be happening. And it was exactly as it had been foretold. They went out with the shepherds, just like it said the people in the hill country who saw John, telling everyone that they saw about these miraculous things. Because like I said, do you believe in miracles? This whole event was a miracle to tell people who would listen. As we close this morning and we reflect, I've got a quote up here from C.S. Lewis, not Spurgeon today. I went a little bit more modern. I got to the 20th century. C.S. Lewis says, God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself, because it is not there. There is no such thing. The world tries to draw peace and happiness and joy from a contaminated well. The sin nature contaminates everything around us. The only way to have real peace, real joy, real happiness is it has to originate from God himself. That's why Jesus was called Emmanuel, God with us. God sent his son to us. That is the nature of the story that we've heard today, to bring light into the darkness, because Jesus is the light of the world.